Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. The author of 40-plus books, a Nobel laureate and activist, Elie Wiesel, is well known as the author of Night, which recounts his daily life in a concentration camp during the height of the Holocaust. It sold over 10 million copies. As a Nobel Peace Prize winner and a Holocaust survivor, he was a trusted confidant of presidents. In 2006, he traveled to Auschwitz with Oprah Winfrey, and in 2009, he traveled to Buchenwald concentration camp with President Obama. But as Wiesel often noted, his most meaningful job was being a teacher. For 35 years, he taught classes at Boston University, classes on memory and literature. Elie Wiesel passed away in 2016 at the age of 87. Ariel Berger was Elie Wiesel's former teaching assistant and lifelong student. He's now a rabbi, and in his new book, Witness, Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom, he recounts the decades of journal entries, classroom notes, and student interviews while exploring Wiesel's teachings on religion, hatred, activism, and memory. Ariel Berger, welcome to All of It.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you.
So you first met Elie Wiesel when you were just a teenager. How so?
Well, I was 15 years old. My soon-to-be stepfather introduced me to Elie Wiesel after a lecture, a public lecture in New York. And they knew each other through a musical project that they had done together. Elie Wiesel was a lover of music and a singer and actually played violin when he was a child. And I met him at the age of 15 at a moment when I was really trying to figure out a lot of things about my life and the relationship between my religious tradition and the arts in particular. I was an artist, a visual artist. And he held his hand out to me, and he said his name as if I had never heard of him before, with tremendous modesty. And I just felt an incredible sense of reverence and also connection right away. And that began a lifelong relationship.
Now, you became his student in your 20s and his teaching assistant in your 30s. Please correct me if I have any of the dates and times wrong. Did you at first decline to become his teaching assistant?
I did. I was his student as an undergrad in Boston University, and I was very shy in class. I said one word the entire semester when he called on me, and the word was authenticity. And a few weeks later, he asked me to become his teaching assistant, and I did decline. I was already planning on studying abroad. I wanted to dive really deeply into traditional study in Israel, and that's what I was planning on doing. So I wrote him a long letter sharing my thought process and kind of apologizing for turning him down and thinking, well, this is an opportunity that's never going to come back. And when I spoke to him after I wrote that letter, he said, I'll wait for you. And I thought he was just being kind, but he meant it. And 7 years later, he invited me again, and I became his TA then.
Before you accepted that assignment, what kind of questions did you ask yourself? What kind of questions did you ask him? Why was it important you to take this position?
Well, I was in touch with him through my 20s, and I met with him sporadically, and I shared a lot of questions with him. I was asking a lot of questions about faith and doubt and religious identity, and in general, how do you pull together the different competing aspects of yourself and your identity? How do I do that? How do I help others do that? What does it mean to be a teacher? What does it mean to be connected to a particular religious tradition but be a universalist? And he was very generous, and his responses to me were usually not answers. I asked questions and he would respond with other questions, but his questions were so much better than mine, so much more precise that they really kind of opened things up for me. And he said things to me like, gave me sort of general principles like superficiality is the enemy of everything, and really focus on what's essential and identify what's essential in your life and try to make more and more of what you do focused on that essential mission and your sense of values. And so when it was time to consider whether to come be his assistant at BU, first of all, I was just incredibly excited to have more opportunities with him to share questions and conversations like that. But I was also really interested in Elie Wiesel, the teacher. And I wanted to know, what does it look like to, what does it feel like to be in his classroom? And that was one of the really important things that drew me to him. At the same time, I was really struggling with a sense that I've been studying for such a long time, I need to give back to the community or to the world somehow. So that was sort of the question that I lived with for several months. But it was really a pretty no-brainer to say yes to him the second time around.
We're speaking with Ariel Berger. The name of his book is Witness, Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom. The first chapter in the book is memory. And it starts, there's a quote, listening to a witness makes you a witness. Why was that such an important message to impart?
Well, that's really what inspired the title of the book. And it was something that Elie Wiesel believed very deeply, that memory, not only memory of facts and the transmission of information, but the process of becoming sensitized through empathy and imagination to other people's experiences, that can really happen. And it can happen through learning, and it can happen through the study of great literature, but it can also happen through hearing people's stories and bearing witness to one another's stories. And so when I hear someone else's story, a Holocaust survivor or someone who's been through an enormous experience of either suffering or discovery or whatever it is, that really changes me, and I now carry that story with me. And he believed that very deeply. So his classroom, in a sense, was a factory for witnesses. He was creating people who could become sensitized, carry his story, but also the stories of people we were reading about in class. And through that process, could become activists, could become more sensitive, more empathic people out in the world.
And in terms of him wanting people to understand why it was important to be a witness, was there any part of that that was political? I mean, little p political?
Well, I don't think he thought of himself as a political person, although, of course, he impacted politics mm-hmm. in this country and elsewhere so deeply. And for him, it was really impossible to separate the two. So, for example, when he taught biblical texts, he was often thinking about the political implications. When he taught the book of Joshua, he said, there's no poetry in this book because there's such an ugly war in this book. And you can't have song where there's war. And on the other hand, when he was talking about politics, he was drawing upon great literature and philosophical traditions to understand what's happening today. For him, it was very seamless. And that was one of the things that was so intriguing to me.
He also really made the point to his students, or wanted to impart to his students, that you can't just be a bystander. You have to engage. How did he encourage people to engage?
Well, for Elie Wiesel, the opposite of being a witness is to be a spectator. And that, in a sense, he said that hatred is a terrible thing, but worse than hatred, of course, is indifference. Because there are many more people who are indifferent to suffering than those who actively cause suffering. And so if we are to make any difference in the world in our smaller spheres of influence or in bigger ways, we need to become active agents of change in the world. We can't be spectators. We can't just see terrible things happening and go back to sleep. And so a lot of what he did with his students was sort of awaken us through study to our moral obligations to others.
The chapter in Memory closes with an example, a sort of a striking question from a student. A student asks Elie Wiesel, will you show us your number? Why did he do so? And did you ever get to the bottom of why the student asked?
That was a very powerful moment. It was the last day of class, and Professor Wiesel always opened the floor to any question that students wanted to ask. And, you know, the student asked, can you show us the number on your arm? And then he immediately turned bright red and kind of hunkered down in his chair. I think he felt really uncomfortable with his own daring. And I think what drove the question was not from a place of skepticism. I think it was a sense of wanting to really see firsthand and be able to say, I saw this firsthand. And Professor Wiesel took off his jacket, rolled up his sleeve, showed the class the tattoo on his arm, rolled his sleeve back down, put his jacket on, and said, next question. And I think that the reason he chose to do that, such an intimate, powerful act, was that he wanted his students to be able to say, this is real. And when I got over my my initial kind of shock and the intensity of the moment, I thought of all the Holocaust deniers and denial websites out there, and the fact that now there's a classroom of 60 some odd students who can say, we saw the number on someone's arm, and that eyewitness testimony, even for people who weren't there, didn't experience those events, is very powerful and very important. I think that's why Professor Wiesel chose to show the class the number on his arm.
Now, this is from his obituary on the Boston University website, where he taught for many, many, many years, that only once did he teach a course on the Holocaust, and he disliked it so much that he never taught it again. Do you know why he disliked teaching that course? And you just explained to us how he was so readily willing to show a student his number.
Yeah, I think first of all, it's important to say that although he never taught a course on the Holocaust, it was, of course, a presence in his classes. And so even if he was teaching a course on banned and censored books or literary responses to oppression, the Holocaust would enter the room at certain points. But he didn't want to teach an entire course on it. He told me why, because it was so devastating to students. And I've actually heard stories from that class and seen classroom notes from that first year. I think it was 1976, where a student was so upset and so destroyed by what they were studying. They were studying first-person accounts of the Holocaust that she left and couldn't really hold the intensity of all of that. And so he was concerned. He didn't want to, on the one hand, he wanted to transmit the message. On the other, he didn't want to destroy the hope and the faith and the optimism of his students. And so I think he decided to do it in a more careful way and in a more developed way through literature and through philosophy and other texts.
We're speaking with Ariel Berger. He's written a book called Witness, Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom. Ariel was his teaching assistant for many years. And I love the first line. It's on page 187. It says, on a cold December morning in Boston, Professor Wiesel is singing to his students. Why did he sing to his students?
I love that. I love that moment. As I mentioned, he loved music and he grew up with music. He grew up in a very pre-war, fervent Jewish Hasidic environment where singing was just something that you did at the Sabbath table and at other special moments. And he told me he always had a song in his head. And that was a part of it, just his love of music. But I think there was something else, which was his sense that in trying to transmit memory and important messages and lessons, language is the only way we have to transmit anything. But language is so limited. He said, you can speak of or write of the deaths of millions of people in one sentence. There's a disconnect between the reality that you're trying to convey and the form that language takes. And so there were moments in class when I think he felt that language, we've come to the limits of language. And if I want to transmit anything to my students from this point onward, I can only do it through song. And he only did that a handful of times when I was there in his classroom. But it was always in a moment when we were encountering that line, the end of language.
But it's also interesting, though, he does make a point to his students that words are incredibly powerful and they have tremendous power and we have to be careful about how we use them and how they can be manipulated.
Absolutely. And he talked about the process of writing his first book, Night. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners know that it was originally written as an 864-page work, and then he cut it down. And he said, you know, I wrote it, and then I cut back, and writing for me was like creating a sculpture where you see the image inside that you're trying to reveal, and you cut away and you pull away. And he said, do you think the words that were there before are no longer there? They're still there in the 100-page version of Night. You just can't see them. So he took language so seriously, and he felt that it was so powerful and dangerous, and that words and language could be corrupted, and that words like selection or fire or chimney are different after the Holocaust. And these words have to cause us to sort of tremble when we hear them. And so he cared deeply about language. He wrote Night. He wrote many other books. And he spoke publicly and to his students. But he was also aware of the limits of that kind of transmission.
We're speaking with Ariel Berger about his book, Witness, Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom. There's an interesting chapter in your book about faith and doubt. Why did you want to discuss faith and doubt about faith? Because you do ask him a question. Is it possible to build a religious life based on doubt?
Right. That was the question I was living with at a certain point in my 20s. And it was a personal question for me, but I wrote about it because it was such a central part of his struggle as a person who grew up in a deeply religious environment. I mean, the young Elie Wiesel was filled with faith. He lived in an environment of faith. He studied mysticism at the age of 13. And then he experienced the Holocaust, and his faith was shattered, but not completely destroyed. And he talked about faith in a new way, as a wounded faith. And he drew on Jewish traditions of wrestling with God, arguing with God, which really begins with the story of Abraham arguing with God on behalf of the people of Sodom, and continues in Jewish history, that you can worship God by arguing with God. You can worship God by demanding that God live up to the ethical intuitions that God has given us. And that's a very profound thing. That was profound for me. I think it's important for the world in thinking about the role of religion in creating conflict, but also in healing the world. And so Elie Wiesel was a religious person who saw the tremendous destructive potential of religion and religious texts and traditions, but also saw that we can't really live without religion, and we have to raise it up and figure out ways of doing that. So for him, wounded faith was the primary way that he wrestled with his own tradition and modeled that, I think, for others.
And before I let you go, as you're touring with this book, it's a lovely book. It's a wonderful, and it's just very, very uplifting and spiritual. But as you're touring with this during this time when there's been an uptick in anti-Semitic violence, and I'm sure people who are listening to this, or maybe they don't know that Elie Wiesel's childhood home in Romania, where the monument was vandalized. As you are speaking about your teacher, your mentor, your own development, as you're on this book tour with the backdrop of things that are happening around the world right now, I wanted to get your perspective on the current rise in hate crimes.
Yeah, I'm thinking about this a lot, of course. And there are several things he taught his students that really are helping me right now to make sense of what's going on. The first is, he said, when you see the early signs of hatred, don't wait, fight it. Hatred is a cancer, and if you wait, if you're silent, your silence helps it grow. But he also said you have to be very careful in how you name things and recognize the different varieties of hate. He said, what's worse than evil? The only thing worse than evil is evil in disguise, evil wearing a mask. And so taking the mask off is really important, and being precise about what's happening to different communities, honoring the particularity of different communities and the victims of different communities, and at the same time, almost paradoxically, learning lessons from each example in the Jewish community and other communities about universal lessons and how we can hold fast together and build friendships and alliances across communities to fight hate.
Ariel Berger's book is Witness, Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom. It's available now. Ariel, thank you so much for joining us on All of It.
Thank you.
Coming up next on All of It, the prescient novel, The Female Persuasion. Meg Walitzer will be here. Don't go away. We'll be right back after a quick break. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Welcome back. The Female Persuasion is Meg Walitzer's 12th novel, her one for grown-ups anyway, and it follows the life of Greer Kadetsky. Greer is an intelligent and initially unsure young woman who finds a mentor and a feminist icon who comes to speak at her college campus, a woman named Faith Frank. Their relationship, their differences, the trajectory of their lives make for an eerily timely tale about female power dynamics. And it offers a sharp look at relationships between different generations and how the boundaries between mentorship and personal advancement can get, well, icky. The Female Persuasion was recently named by the New York Times as one of the 100 notable books of 2018. And Meg Walitzer is in studio. Hi, Meg.
Hi.
You are hosting an upcoming Selected Shorts evening at Symphony Space on Wednesday, the 28th, and featuring authors like James McBride and Lauren Groff, many other people. Is it Riverhead Books? Big
yes,
celebration?
Yes, it's a Riverhead anniversary. I'm really, really excited that to be hosting that and to celebrate them.
Congratulations, by the way.
Oh, thank
this
you.
This is very, very exciting.
Thank
I know you. It's so funny that people say, Meg Walitzer's having this moment. Like you started writing this book a year ago. Like books that are 486
right, exactly.
pages.
Right, exactly. I know. I've joked that I would have to have gotten a lot of people into a room calling themselves Meg Walitzer so it could come out in time for the Me Too movement.
You've worked on this. Started 3-4 years ago?
Yeah, over 4 years ago now. It's been a long time because some of the themes of the book, female power, misogyny, making meaning, are things that we've all been thinking about for a very long time.
And I read in one interview you said that, you know, writers always told write what you know, but you say write what you're obsessed with.
Definitely. And there's one way to know what you're obsessed with, but nobody would want to do it. Look at everything you've Googled for the past 24 hours. It's terrifying, right? You would know who you are. I joke that for me, it would be a combination of Virginia Woolf and does this mole look suspicious?
Is this on sale at Zappos?
Right, exactly.
I clearly am obsessed with
that's
shoes.
That's your next novel. Right, exactly.
So one of the most important themes of this novel, and we'll talk about the plot in a minute, is this idea of somebody comes into your life and changes your life.
Yes.
You meet somebody who just alters alters the way you're going to live. Did that happen for you?
Definitely. It happened to me in a number of ways. There's a dedication to the book to 8 different women. And these are all women who were uncommonly generous to me when I was young. One of them is the writer Nora Ephron and director Nora Ephron, who the first film that she ever directed was based on my novel. The film was called This Is My Life. Mm-hmm. And basically, very few people saw it, although it's streaming. But it was a wonderful film, and she brought me into the process because she'd never directed before. She'd written films. She was a wonderful essayist, mm-hmm. journalist, novelist, humorist. And one of the things that I think I got from her was that being funny can be serious. It's serious business. And there are jokes. They're not really jokes, but moments that I've put into my novels that I wish I could show her now. Mm-hmm. Like, there's this tiny moment in this book where Greer, who's very shy when she's a child, is left to sort of sit under the whiteboard with the weird girl eating Pringles. And the weird girl in the class says to her, "Do you ever think about poisoning our teacher?" And Greer says, "No." And then the weird girl says, "Yeah, neither do I." And I thought, the joke isn't like insert joke here, but I think what novelists do, what I try to do anyway, is have humor sort of blossom from character. And I think Nora really tried to do that and appreciated that, really, more to the point.
Yeah, one of my favorite lines of hers, "I feel bad about my neck."
Yeah.
And you knew exactly what that means.
Right, it said everything. It was succinct. It said everything. And she just, you just wanted to show her your work. I admired her so much. And when she admired something I did, it felt wonderful. And she was very, very generous. After she died, a lot of people kind of started talking about how she had called them up and taken them to lunch and given them advice and offered them really important things because she admired their work, and that meant so much to them.
And even, I think she did that with someone who even wrote something mean about her, and they became Rebecca Traister.
Right.
Had written something, and then yes.
They became good friends.
Good friends. Yes. That shows you how big her heart was.
And no, very much so. And I think that these people, a friend of mine calls them, you know, the people who give us permission calls them permissionaries, which I love. But they can change how you see yourself, because I think what happens is someone older, it doesn't have to be someone older, but someone you admire takes you seriously. Basically, that gives you no excuse to not take yourself, you know, no excuse not to take yourself seriously anymore. And I think that that allowed me to do that from an earlier age.
One of the women on here is your mom, Hilma Wurlitzer, one of the...
Yes, she is a novelist. She is 88 and going very strong. She started publishing and writing late. Her parents hadn't thought that it was important for girls to get a higher education, so she took a class here and there but never went to college. Sold her first short story when I was a child, put a down payment on a station wagon. But to give you a sense of her mindset at the time, this is the 60s, mid-60s, she was a housewife. Her story was called "Today a Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket." And I think she would have gone a little mad if she hadn't had an outlet for expression.
So interesting.
Yeah, these are people who matter. I did a Q&A once after a reading, and a woman stood up and said, "My daughter wants to be a playwright, but I know how hard it is to make it. What should I tell her?" And I said, and she said, you know, she's really, really good. And I said, "Well, is she burning to do it?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, I think you should tell her that's wonderful, because the world will whittle your daughter down, but a mother never should. And mine never did either. And I think that's why I'm here."
Okay, I'm putting a post-it, an imaginary post-it next to that, because I want to talk about the wife.
Sure.
In a little bit, because there's
sure.
a scene in the wife that just reminded me of this. We're speaking with Meg Walzer about her new novel, The Female Persuasion. So the novel begins with Greer. Named Jermaine Greer?
Well, you know, unconsciously, everybody asked me that. And, you know, my mom had a copy of The Female Eunuch by Jermaine Greer on her shelf back in the day. And I love naming things. I thought that there was a job when I was a child naming streets. I would fill notebooks with Greenwood Court and hope that I could sell it. I don't know. It's up for offer if anybody would like to buy those books. Probably in the back of my mind, yes, definitely.
Seeped in there somewhere.
Yeah.
So Greer, she goes off to college. She, you know, what does she want to be when she gets to college? Does she know?
She doesn't know. She's kind of quiet and lost. The book is really about finding your own voice. She experiences, she's groped by a frat brother at a party. And this experience, she's not sure, wait a minute, did something real happen to me? Do I have a right to feel upset? Was it an assault?
Right, this happens early on in the book, and he's kind of just a jerk,
he's a
too.
Jerk,
he's
yeah.
just like a real, and he's a jerk to a
and
lot of women on campus.
And the college basically says, oh, have three therapy sessions and you can stay.
Right.
And she feels the outrage of this. And when the famous feminist Faith Frank, who's kind of described as a couple of steps down in fame from Gloria Steinem, comes to campus, Greer wants to talk to her and ask her, what can I do about how it feels and how it feels to be female in the world? Is this what it's always going to feel like? So there's that moment when you meet that person, if you're lucky enough to have mm-hmm. that happen, and things might change.
And when Greer stands, she stands up to ask the question,
yeah.
and your description of her is, it's just that moment. We've all had that moment when you know you need to do something, but you're so terrified, and then you halfway through you think, I've just really mucked this up. There's no way that this is working out for me. And then it actually works out for her.
Yeah, because she's a shy person and she's an introvert. And there's a line in the book that I think Faith says that sometimes the most successful people are introverts who learn how to be extroverts. And we watch her trajectory from this very introverted girl who doesn't really know what she wants to do, finding her way through this older woman who sees something in her and helps her.
And then there's the interesting issue of that moment when you realize this person who you idolize and who's your mentor is a human being and has faults and warts and all of it.
It can be very depressing. I mean, it's sort of like when you see your teacher in the supermarket as a child and their shopping cart is filled with, you know, bird's eye peas and Kotex. What? Wait a minute. What? Who are you, lady? You're my perfect teacher. But people are many things, and people are not perfect. I mean, I think that these characters are certainly not perfect, and you hear from readers mad at you for making a character behave in a certain way, but I think a writer has to tolerate readers being annoyed with the things their characters do. It comes with the territory.
When you think about someone who's a feminist icon like Faith, and you wanted to give her foibles, you wanted to give her points that would make another feminist go ew, what did you line up?
Well, I try to really make it who she is rather than a kind of like what would a generic feminist have wrong with her.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to make her, I mean, there have been criticisms of second wave feminism as being elitist. Some of these criticisms are leveled at Faith in the book, and she tries to take them on in certain ways or deflect them. I think one of the things about Faith is really an issue kind of late in the book about compromise and mm-hmm. what do we do about compromise. For me as a novelist, I don't know the answers to what we do about things. I mean, people turn to novelists and want answers. But what I like to do, my mantra is show what is it like? What is it like? What is it like for this person? She wants to inspire more generally, and rather than have these sort of very intimate close-up relationships, she likes the idea of inspiring someone like Greer. But what if it goes a little bit mm-hmm. south? What if it goes awry? What happens then?
And do we hold our mentors and our idols up? You know, Faith wants, she gets her hair colored.
Yeah, there's a scene where we see her with foils and looking like a Martian.
As if though she can't possibly be giving into mainstream beauty standards by coloring
right,
her hair.
Right, exactly. No, because people are complicated and they aren't one thing and they don't have to be one thing. But when we fantasize and make and give them the Freudian term transference, when we put things like from our past onto people in the present, we are bound to finally be disappointed when we see who they really are, because we are kind of geodesic domes. We have many sides. We hold a lot of different parts. And I hope that these characters do too. As in all the fiction that I read, I it's about often about imperfection.
We're speaking with Meg Wolitzer about her novel, The Female Persuasion. So when you think about how Greer thinks about feminism, because Greer goes on to have a great career, I'm not giving too much away, and you think about how Faith thinks about feminism, when you were writing their two characters, what's the origin story of each of their feminism? For Greer, is it that groping? What was it for Faith?
Well, for Faith, back in the 1960s, her friend has an illegal abortion and hemorrhages, and Faith is there for that and sees what happens and sees the price that can happen. And she wants to be involved in abortion rights, and she does become involved in it. And through that, she finds a way through conversations with other women about reproductive freedoms and other things, you know, move from there. I kind of feel like there can be an origin story, but more than that, we're all marinating in different issues as women, for instance. I mean, for me, I was in a consciousness-raising group, a term that sounds right now sort of like I'm talking about, I don't know, a butter churn. It seems so old. And yet, for me, it's very, very touching because I remember it well. And the women who were in such groups where people talked about things that they didn't necessarily talk about openly, it mattered. It mattered a lot. My group, we were about 13 or 14, we wrote away to the National Organization for Women asking for a list of topics. And they sent us a list of topics that included things like sexual fulfillment and you.
Wow.
When we wanted things like studying for your SATs, don't stress out. But we were young women. We were becoming young women. And we were taking ourselves seriously. And we were taking the notion of really autonomy seriously. How do you become a woman in the world? What are the rights? I mean, we had to march into the principal's office to be able to wear pants to school. My sister brought this up at Thanksgiving and we all laughed thinking about it. But that wasn't that long ago and we had to do that. And we've seen things change in many, many ways. And then of course this year we have this election. So I'm aware as a novelist of time, I love thinking about how things move or don't move over great periods of time.
We had in the director, the writer, and the star of Gloria, A Life. Have you gotten to see it yet?
I'm dying to see it. This is Emily Mann,
yes,
who is my friend.
You need to see it.
I'm very eager to see it, and I'm planning to do it very soon.
And it's very interesting because they do a talk back after, and they were all sharing, Christine Lotti, Emily Mann, and Diana Paulson, were sharing that how many young women stand up and say, I had no idea.
Right.
That it was like this. And I had no idea it was like this so recently about birth control being illegal or not being able to own property unless it was in your husband's name, those kind of things. And I think that's sort of a really interesting part of the novel is that friction between the generations about what it means to be a strong woman.
One of the conversations that I had with my editor when I was writing the book was the ways in which feminists from different generations grew up in different worlds. So of course they see things differently. Their experiences were different. Their cohort was different. The conversations were different. So they are going to approach it differently. It all comes down to character. I mean, if you write a novel about these issues, but it feels like a political tract or tries to include everything and becomes a big social comprehensive study, I don't know how you make it feel like it's about people. And I just, again, back to that idea, what is it like for these people? But it happens to have a political heart and it happens to be about how we make meaning and how we cope with these matters.
The book is going to be a movie.
Yes.
And Nicole Kidman is going to play Faith. Is that right?
I'm very, very excited about it. Nicole Kidman has optioned it along with the wonderful producer, Linda Obst, and Amazon is doing it. And I hope that she will play her. It's all, you know, it's early days to figure out how it will all shake down. But when you're writing a book, you never, you know, people ask writers, did you picture who you wanted? And I never think about it as a film. For me, my characters kind of have blurry faces like the people in the background on a reality TV mm-hmm. show, but I know them very intimately. I know how they look, but it's not about, you know, who they are as an actor. It's about who they are, of course, in an interior way. But it's a thrill when an actor you admire is attached to a film, to the film of your book.
You've been through this process of before, you luckily, happily, of taking a book to film. Do you have to let go at some point?
Well, you know, I have a film out right now based on my novel, The Wife.
I was going to see it yesterday in preparation to talk to you. I've got questions.
Okay. Well, I don't want to jump on that then.
That's okay.
Too much,
go for it.
That was a very interesting experience because the book is 15 years old. So it was one of these incredibly slow things. It's like that old commercial, we will serve no wine before it's time. This one. But what was interesting, as with the novel, The Female Persuasion, I mean, this book, the film of The Wife has landed in this moment when it's really, I mean, it's about female rage and about who gets a chance to have a voice. It dovetails with some of the themes in The Female Persuasion.
So the premise of this, the book and this movie. Glenn Close plays the wife of a gentleman, Joseph Castleman, who is about to get the Nobel Prize in Literature. And it becomes clear pretty early on that she's been doing his writing, that she is the ghostwriter and has been the spouse throughout the entirety of the career and the fame and all of it. And what that is like for her as someone, a sort of dogged reporter, kind of thinks he knows this and is going to get a scoop.
Well, you know, one of the things that I noted is the ways in which Glenn Close, who plays the wife, the title character, uses her face.
Amazing.
To say things that I need many, many paragraphs and chapters to say. I've said to her, basically, like everybody, how do you do that? Because I could look in a mirror and try to look a certain way and it would never come out. She really goes very, very deeply into this character, and it was very exciting and astonishing. And it took a long time before the film could get made, but it's been received really well, and I think the actors are absolutely wonderful.
And the title's just said it's the wife, that person.
Right, next she's to the wife, right. The person standing next to the powerful person, but she's the, you know... She has a line where she says, I'm much more interesting than that. You know, don't paint me a victim. I'm much more interesting than that. And indeed she is.
It's interesting because the book takes place in 1992 and then you have this book out now. It's an interesting bookend that you're surrounded by all this right now.
It's a weird year.
It's definitely an interesting year.
Yeah. Definitely an interesting year. A fertile year in this regard.
Can you imagine how boring your book tour would have been?
Oh my God.
Asking you like probably really sort of, I don't want to say stupid questions, uninformed questions. People are so informed about the issue now, you know?
No, I know. Issues. You know, I was actually on a plane on my, I had a month-long book tour for The Female Persuasion that Riverhead sent me on. And I got off a plane and was waiting for my bag. And two people like texted me, did you see the tweet from Nicole Kidman? I was like, what? No. And she had put a picture of herself reading my book. And while it was just so odd, I mean, because as a fiction writer, we live in a nonfiction world, by which I mean we are absolutely glued to what is happening. Like while you and I have been sitting here talking, I don't know what's happened, and I'm going to find out, mm-hmm. and so are you the minute we stop talking.
After one day on the air, like, yeah, Jeff Sessions got canceled.
Right, exactly.
Like, what?
Right, I know. What? But fiction does something different. I mean, fiction does something different. Which is it's not the hot take, it's the warm take. And sometimes it's about these things that are in the news. Not that I try to capitalize on the news, because as I said, I've been thinking about mm-hmm. both of these things for so long. But if you can have the time to write a novel about something, Mary Gordon, the great novelist, said that the novel is the opposite of the tweet. You take your time to sort of explore issues that are important to you through character, through scene, through language, which is what I care about. And I did try to do that in both of those books. And I feel very, very grateful that, you know, that they sort of came to the eyes of film people this year.
So what's on your mind now that we might see in a book down the road?
Whatever it is, perhaps the year that it comes out will be exploding with that. No, I mean, I think a novel that is written for the moment is sort of an oxymoron.
Yeah,
because
can't
you want
be.
It. No, it can't be. You don't want it to be. Mm-hmm. You don't want it to be at all. I'm starting something new, but I don't know yet that, you know, it's such early days that it's like a secret love affair that I'm having, so I can't tell you.
Okay. I'll let you keep that, too.
Yeah, definitely.
Megan Walter, it was a pleasure to meet you. The name of the book is The Female Persuasion. It is a great read. Congratulations on all your success. Meg Walter is hosting an event called Selected Shorts in celebration of the 25th anniversary of Riverhead Books. It will be at Symphony Space this Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. Coming up next on All of It, a conversation with WNYC's own Helga Davis. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. The performer and artist Helga Davis has worked in opera, theater, in the fine art world. She was the principal actor in Robert Wilson and Philip Glass's opera Einstein on the Beach. She also starred in Robert Wilson's The Temperature of St. Anthony, completed her first full-length theater piece, Cassandra, and performed in Oceanic Verses, a multimedia opera written for her by composer Paolo Pristini. Helga has been working with us here at WNYC and WQXR.
Yes.
She's hosted live events for New Sounds and formerly for QXR's Q2 Music. And now...
And now...
You can add Podcaster to your CV.
Oh, yes.
The second season of Helga is out now, and a special broadcast of Helga will be on WNYC 9 p.m. Eastern Time throughout this week. Helga, welcome
to
the studio.
It's so exciting, and it's really great to be here with you, not in my socks and undies walking around my apartment trying to get outside.
So I'm gonna turn the tables on you.
Ooh.
This is a quintessentially Helga question.
Ooh.
You often ask people on your podcast.
Ooh.
Who are you?
Oh, not that.
Oh, no, not that.
You know what's interesting about that question is that it doesn't really have an answer, right? And part of what's fun about this podcast in particular is that you don't just get the performer or the writer or the singer coming to you, yeah? You get the person. You get kind of a multi-dimensional aspect of the people that you know and are curious about who do one thing. I think that's also why it's important for me to have used the word conversation instead of interview. I think when a person has an interview, they come and you're already reducing a little bit who that person is because they're coming in to talk about a book.
Very specific thing,
it's very, very specific. And for this, let's take Solange, for instance. Solange came in, she had a number one record. She had just been on Saturday Night Live. We didn't talk about any of that. We talked about Solange, the single mother. We talked about Solange, who had to leave her child at home with her husband, but who was going to be picked up by the child's father and the complications around all those feelings. Or Hilton Ahls, who had come in right after he won the Pulitzer. We didn't talk about that at all. We talked about him just arriving to the studio from Analysis. Mm-hmm. Like, this is a very, very different way to relate to the people that we know and that we love and who are important in our culture. And it doesn't just wave the shiny object mm-hmm. at us. It brings the person in their totality to a conversation that I think also helps just regular people.
So I'm going to go back to that. With all that in mind, that description, who are you?
Uh-oh.
Are you a New Yorker? I listed all the amazing accomplishments you have, but when you think about yourself and who are you?
I say yes. I'm not going to choose.
I
feel like all of this is part of one conversation. And I don't feel like the singer or the performer or the host or any one of those things, I feel really like all of those things.
Has that been that way since you were a little girl, or is that something that you evolved into and matured into?
I think I probably evolved and matured into that because I am not any different than anyone else who feels like, well, you have to choose, right? You go to college and you choose a major, you graduate from college and then you choose the thing that you're going to do. You meet a person and you choose the relationship you think you should be in. And this, I don't feel like that at all anymore. And right now, what feels important is to show up and say, well, who am I and who are you?
One of the great things about the podcast, if you haven't a chance to hear it, and you can hear it on the radio tonight at 9 all week long, is that you're friendly with a lot of your guests. So there's a certain sort of artifice that's just gone because y'all know
intimate.
Each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't even have to get to that warming up phase. I wanted to play a little bit of Thelma Golden of the Studio Museum. This is very interesting. There's a point when she talks about seeing you on the streets and her description of you just living your life and being you.
Okay.
Let's take a listen.
All right.
I too have had that feeling of crossing paths with you, though I have to say some of my favorite Harlem moments are seeing you sort of command Lenox Avenue as you walk down it. And once I get into your field of vision and our eyes do cross and we have that hello and we have that hug, that's, you know, I love it.
Why was it important to you have someone like Thelma? I mean, she's, again, incredibly accomplished person past the accomplishments. Mm-hmm. Why did you want to have her on?
Because this is a person I've known for 15 years, and in those 15 years have never had an opportunity to just sit down with her and talk and find out. I know lots of things about her. Mm-hmm. I can read things on the internet. But she's a person who has always sparked my curiosity. We know a lot of the same people. And I was doing this thing where I was talking to people, and I thought, this is a perfect opportunity to finally have the paths meet and mm-hmm. stop crossing.
She's funny though, in this particular episode, she turns the tables on you.
A little bit.
A little bit. Let's listen. I think it's clip 3.
I want to ask you what you think it means to be a Black artist now.
One of the things that, an experience I had very recently, I was working on a piece with someone and I was trying to figure out what I was going to do. And I'm always, always interested in how do I turn the thing on its head. And so I started working on this rendition of the national anthem. Mm-hmm. But in the what I understand about it is that those words from my mouth can be a bomb. Mm-hmm. And this is the place I must explore. This is the place I have to live from. This is how my being here makes sense.
How did you feel about having her turn the tables on you like that?
Well, it's a conversation, right? And I feel that I can't ask a person to be, to reveal themselves, to extend themselves in a way that I am also not willing to. It doesn't seem like the right thing. And so I didn't so much feel that the tables were turned, but rather that we were doing exactly what we were supposed to do, which is to exchange.
Having exchange is the word I was going
to
say.
To be in conversation.
It's interesting, though. I think that sometimes when people, it's interesting how people sometimes let their guard down in conversation. I have found that. Early on in the show, we had somebody on who's just got so into the conversation that she swore on the air. Uh-huh. And the way I felt like that was a really big compliment, that she got that comfortable, mm-hmm. that she forgot that she was on the radio live. Right. Those are kind of magic moments. Have you had any of those sort of, not particularly the cursing part, but those moments when you think like, oh, this is exactly what I was hoping this would be?
Well, you know what's funny with these episodes? They're all my baby, right? So you don't love one of your children more than you love the other. But I feel that what is beautiful is that, yes, in every single episode, there is a level of intimacy that is assumed and that is present from the very beginning. And it's like you said, these are people I know. So mm-hmm. I'm really not coming at them as from a stranger's point of view. They are people I know and love and have relationships with, but maybe it's someone I haven't seen for a long time. I loved that, for instance, that I got to go back with Kenneth Lonergan,
the playwright
with whom I went to high school, and that we got to talk about the moment when we were in a play. So I was in ninth grade, I guess he was in 11th grade, and he appeared in blackface. And even after all these years, I was still affected by that. Mm. I was still, I needed to tell him that we were in ninth grade and 11th grade, but that in that moment, that action didn't allow me to see my friend, didn't allow me to see the person that I knew as Kenny. And to have the opportunity to sit with him and to look at mm-hmm. him and to close that circle for both of us was very, very powerful and beautiful and important.
Who else can we expect to hear this week?
So we have Thelma Golden and Peter Sellers. We have Sarah Jones and the singer-songwriter Sharon Nova. Mm-hmm. There is Miss Solange Knowles. There's Christopher Jackson and Jacqueline Woodson. Those are my book babies. And Kenneth Lonergan and Hilton Alls.
It's so interesting about Kenneth. I can imagine, I've interviewed him, and he's a really thoughtful guy.
He is.
And I can just really imagine how difficult, but also that he would be greatly appreciative of that conversation.
Absolutely. And you hear that. You hear that in the conversation. And I feel that all of these conversations have that element. And also the element of, wow, what does it mean for my friend to see me now and to have seen me then?
All right, everybody, you can check it out. It's Helga. It'll be on Helga. WNYC, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, all this week. The podcast is called Helga as well. Helga, thank you so much
thank
for stopping by.
Thank you so much.
That's our show. We appreciate you listening to all of it. Join us tomorrow at noon on WNYC. You can follow all of it on Instagram, at Twitter. Our handle is @allofitWNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thanks for listening.